Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Stick around after the show for an interview with Clay Baldo, the host of Strangers in China, the newest podcast at SubChina, which will debut September 19th.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is the best way to keep on top of all the latest news from China in just a few minutes a day through our email newsletter, our smartphone app, or at the website subchina.com. We offer original reporting and perspectives on a range of China-related topics, from the Belt and Road to the environment, from the latest online phenomena to the ongoing repression of Uyghurs and other Muslims in China's Xinjiang region. We're sure you'll agree that it's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you today from Denver, Colorado, where the 2019 AAS Conference, the Association for Asian Studies Conference, is throwing its annual shindig. It's been a terrific, terrific conference, and as you can imagine, we've managed now to line up many, many guests for future episodes, so stay tuned. Today on Seneca, I am delighted to be joined by Ed Pulford, a postdoctoral researcher at Hokkaido University, who I actually met last year at AAS, of all things. Ed is the author of a brand new book called Mirrorlands, Russia, China, and Journeys in Between. Ed is a Cambridge-trained linguist and anthropologist who is fluent in both Russian and Mandarin Chinese, and we've just been talking about just now about learning Japanese and Korean. He's at Hokkaido, so naturally Japanese. His book is a kind of, I would describe it as an erudite anthropological travelogue that focuses on the paired cities and towns facing each other across the long Sino-Russian border. It's full of lots of adventures and well-made observations with plenty of wit and humor, and all without a bit of mean-spiritedness, which is really impressive. Ed Pulford, welcome to Seneca.
Thank you very much, Kaiser. It's great to be here.
So, Ed, what inspired you to write a book of this nature? I mean, it's not an academic book, obviously. It's not a mere travelogue, that's for sure. People might think of Paul Thoreau, maybe, that sort of thing, a kind of smart travelogue. But I don't like Paul Thoreau. He's not an attractive character to me. He doesn't come out. Where, you know, you're much more sympathetic. The places you go really are out of the way, very much off the beaten path. There's not much by way of inspiring natural vistas or magnificent architecture.
Right. But,
and there were no calamitous wars or massive political repression, no big flows of refugees, no illegal immigration, no drug smuggling. I mean, there's not a lot of anything going on. In fact, the people you write about are ordinary, kind of quirky, maybe, but quotidian, right?
I wouldn't say there's no illegal migration or drug smuggling, but not things that I personally wanted to get too involved in either Russia or China. But in terms of inspiration, I spent many years living in both countries. I studied Russian as an undergrad in the UK. And during that time, also got very interested in China, and so spent a year abroad that I had during the third year of my bachelor's in Vladivostok in the Russian Far East, and studied Chinese there at a local university in order to try to understand this connection. And I suppose, in some ways, everything I've done since then has been an effort to make sense of that probably somewhat bizarre decision made, you know, in the fit of extremes that early 20s British boy may have. But in any case, after graduating, I then decided to get into this China thing a bit more seriously. I lived for a couple of years in Wuhan immediately after graduating, then for a year in Xinjiang, and then returned to the UK again after that and started postgraduate studies. But I suppose I always had this in mind that I wanted to sort of encapsulate some of these experiences living in the two countries. The relationship between the two was always something that interested me. And in a sense, I guess, although the PhD, of course, was my main occupation for a while, I wanted to do something that explained in a way that people, for example, my mum would understand about what I've been up to for the last sort of 10 or so years. I'd spent a bit more time in China during my doctoral studies. And I guess, mainly I was wanting to put a kind of cap on this decade of wandering around these places, which, as you say, are somewhat unknown to people, and probably for good reason, because they're not necessarily immediately popular tourist sites, if you like.
So the book draws on a lot of your past experiences there, but it's written in a sort of present tense of a trip you actually took from Moscow to Beijing, and with lots of meanderings along the border in between. Can you sketch out the journey and try to give our listeners a sense of how much distance you covered, some of the weird places? And we'll talk about a lot of the places you stopped and wrote about, how you did it and how long it took.
Yeah, so that's right. I guess I wanted to have a vehicle for drawing together some of the broader deductions that I've made over time, and sort of my own, however inadequate understanding that I, whatever I'd reached of both places. But a journey zigzagging across the border seemed like a good way of doing that. So I made that a couple of years ago, 3 years ago. I set off from Moscow. Basically, I thought, the Moscow-Beijing thing would be a good way of drawing together not only the immediate borderland relationship, but also putting that into dialogue with the broader Russia-China as larger entities kind of dynamic. And so I made plans to get to Moscow. I then, rather than doing, I guess, what is still not a wildly popular route, but one that people do a little more, the Trans-Siberian, which you can do if you so choose, right, directly from Moscow to Beijing or the other way around in a week without getting off. I did once do it from Vladivostok to Moscow without stopping. But I decided I wanted to do a route that took in more diversity of both places. And so I initially flew to the kind of edge of this area that blurs between what we call Siberia and what is actually officially called the Russian Far East. Now, even people from central part of Russia, from Moscow or St. Petersburg, the far western part of Russia, don't really readily distinguish between Siberia and the Far East.
It's over the Urals, though.
That's correct. Well, everything beyond the Urals is either Siberia or the Far East. Right. So from the Urals to a kind of ill-defined area quite a long way, several thousand miles east of there, is Siberia. And then the Russian Far East is the area that, I guess, includes the sort of eastern seaboard, if you like, running all the way from Chukotka, which is the bit next to Alaska, all the way down to where Vladivostok is, in maritime province, Primorsky Krai, it's called, which is right next to
North Korea
and China, and the sort of triple border area, which incidentally is what I wrote my PhD about.
Right, you were based in Huchun, which is this Chinese city that's at the triple border, basically.
That's right, yeah, that was my PhD subject.
But we'll talk about that.
Yeah. Sure, yeah, yeah.
How long did the whole thing take you then?
I spent a couple of months on the road, I guess, which, given the distance involved, I mean, the border alone is 4,500 kilometers.
Well,
yeah, I mean, that's the border if you just do it directly. And I was, you know, somewhat meandering. So actually, even a couple of months over that distance, you need to be moving with relative speed.
But I lost count of the number of times you actually crossed the border, though. It was, I mean, you actually threaded back and forth in many. It must have looked very suspicious.
Yeah, I did wonder each time. I mean, that's something I try to reflect on a bit in the book regarding what on earth people thought I was doing, because there are border crossings between the two countries where third country citizens, so people not from Russia or China, are not permitted to cross. So I was made sure to choose places where I would be officially allowed, but even places where you're officially allowed, it doesn't mean you're expected by any means. I started in Russia, as I say, came down from this sort of westernmost part of the Far East, or the part where Siberia meets the Russian Far East, came down, crossed into China, moved east from there, back into Russia again, continued to move east, and then back into China again. So I guess in total, three border crossings, Russia-China, China-Russia, and then back into Russia-China again to make it to Beijing ultimately.
The book is filled with all sorts of amusing characters. I mean, these are Russians in the Far East, members of many different ethnic groups that I think lots of folks listening probably haven't even heard of. They were real hard-drinking types on both sides of the borders. let's be honest here. There had to be a pretty strong temptation to get in a laugh at their expense. But as I said, I think you managed to refrain from doing that, and you're pretty good about, you know, not being a jerk.
Well, I mean, I guess it's something I strive to adhere to, non-jerkish behavior in most of my activities. In terms of the humorous side, it was, I'm pleased you sort of read it that way, because it was certainly my intention to draw out some of the undoubted humor, which I think really pervades and washes over. It's one of the many things that I guess unifies the furthest eastern parts of Russia and the Chinese northeast. The kind of wit and the sly sarcasm, I mean, not always something that I think is readily associated with what might broadly be understood to be Chinese humor, but actually, you know, the Dongbei character, I think, has some things in common with
Dongbei is the repository really of all Chinese humor. I mean, Tianjin, Dongbei, and to some extent Beijing. But,
right, and so as a result, I don't think I felt like I needed to generate humor out of my own mind, because there's an awful lot that in a relatively anthropological way you can draw directly from the source. Part of this may well be coming from a British background where a certain form of sardonic, cynical humor is the norm, maybe even tediously so for some many outsiders and indeed some insiders. But I think as a result, the kind of readiness with which people make dark allusions to things in order to joke, both in Russia and as I say, in Northeast China, right, means that there's plentiful material there. You don't need to invent things from your own back.
I mean, to keep you honest, you make all these quirky little historical sallies and discussions of other travelers who had done the same route in one direction or the other. One of them has this sort of fabulously Dickensian name that just evokes exactly what her personality was like in Ethel Alec Tweedy.
That's right, yeah. An aristocratic British traveler during the 1920s.
It's just kind of a reminder throughout just how not to write about your travels, maybe.
Yeah, I think I was conflicted. The main sources, as you mentioned, that I use as a kind of window onto the past, because the book, it's carried forward by my journey in the present, but it seeks to provide a window into what the region and what the dynamic between the two countries has been in decades and indeed centuries past. And so I found quite a useful window onto that were these historical travel logs written by figures like Chu Qiaobai, who's quite well known.
Chu Qiaobai, I mean, maybe we can ID him very quickly. He sure was an early communist luminary and one of the literati intellectuals. Mm-hmm. Later had a falling out with the party.
Right. Well, and actually at this stage, when he was making this journey in 1920-21, he was not, in fact, fully convinced of communism as the particular ideology. But then from the other side, there are a couple of Russian leftist revolutionaries as well, traveling to Japan and China, who again made similar journeys, one of whom is Sergei Tretyakov, who is a extremely wry observer of a lot of what was going on. And I think, again, I mean, that the humor in both what Chu Qiaobai writes and Tretyakov, and the mix of that with this kind of giddy idealism of what was going on a century ago in the immediate aftermath of the Russian Revolution, seemed a really good window into what has united the two countries for the last 100 years in particular. But Ethel Alec Tweedy, Ethel Brilliana Alec Tweedy, indeed, I think I didn't want to be uncharitable to her, because in many regards, as a female traveler, of whatever social class in the 1920s, this was a pretty extraordinary thing to be doing.
Absolutely.
I mean, her book, which documents that journey, in the immediate aftermath of the Russian Revolution, Russia racked by civil war. She's absolutely disgusted by more or less everything she sees along the way. But in any case, I didn't want to be too uncharitable to someone who, regardless of the tone in which she writes, is a pretty intrepid figure. But in any case, I think it was difficult to resist at least not counterposing her rather negative take on everything, you know, the kind of global bourgeoisie being threatened by these Russian and Chinese leftists, with that idealism that I mentioned on the part of Russian and Chinese people themselves doing that journey at the same time.
Speaking of idealists, you also have this really sort of painfully earnest proselytizer of Esperanto, a Chinese scholar who, I can't remember his name now.
Yeah, Hu Yuzhi.
Yeah, Hu Yuzhi. Mm. Tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, so he'd spent a period of time in Europe. So actually, in terms of trajectories, I'm going west to east, Moscow to Beijing. But the journeys that the others are taking, some of them are in the other direction. So Chu Qiaobai, for example, is coming back or coming to Moscow from China at the time. He was going to work as a newspaper reporter for this Beijing-based newspaper, Shanghai-based newspaper Chenbao in Moscow. But Hu Yuzhi had spent a period of time in Europe immediately preceding his Trans-Siberian trip. And so he is traveling back across, spends a period of time in Moscow, and then gets on the train to return to China. And yeah, he was an interesting figure as well, a kind of a leftist, but not necessarily someone who was immediately caught up with the kind of mainstream, I guess, at that point of Chinese communist thoughts. He was mid-30s, we're talking, so somewhat later than a decade or a little more later than Chu Chou-bai. But yeah, he was an Esperantist, a kind of someone like a lot of these figures, and this is what I want to try to bring out, who was just incredibly inspired by the Bolshevik Revolution and by something that seemed to be offering a completely new vision of how you might run an enormous land empire, which you know, both Russia and China are and have been for a very long time.
So we obviously can't talk about every town he visited along the way. Let's just pick out a few places to focus on. One that I wanted to talk about first is the town of Nerchinsk. Students of late imperial China will know that name because of the treaty that was signed between Tsarist Russia and the Qing Dynasty in, what was that, 1689? Talk about what led up to that, though, because there's a lot of history that I think most people sort of glance over. The town of Albazin, which was founded by, you know, like renegade Cossacks.
That's
very interesting, like what happened, and give us a sense of the historical forces that collided there. It reminds me of the expanding the Empire of Islam and the Tang Empire and meeting at the Battle of Talas.
I think
742. Yes,
this is a particularly sort of emblematic. It's a site which, as you say, a lot of people have heard of in kind of vague terms. And as you mentioned, there have been periods in the past where big land sort of imperia have collided somewhere. And you know, in a sense, I think one of the most interesting aspects of the Russia-China relationship, both on the macro level and on the ground, is that these two things are still there, right? That this collision that occurred, as you say, in the 1680s was the kind of where it came to a head, and the Qing were successful in booting out the Russians from part of land that they'd kind of come into. But from then until now, you know, those two polities in varied forms have existed right up to the present. And so, yeah, so the kind of, I tried to trace some of this, the precursors to this Nerchinsk treaty and kind of what led up to that, by starting in Yakutsk, in fact, which was the kind of main stockade from which the final push that Russian Cossacks and their sponsors back in Moscow made to the furthest eastern part, to the eastern seaboard, as I say, of Russia, Sea of Ochotsk and this region. And so preceding their sort of incursion into what was at the time, this is the mid to late 17th century, this was the kind of edge, the fringes of Qing territorial awareness. I mean, of course, we're talking about a period when the Qing had only been established for a few decades following 1644, but the kind of growing presence of Tsarist forces or Cossacks who for a long time would often operate in, as in many colonial endeavors, think of the East India Company or other such comparisons, were operating kind of as private independent actors, pillaging and grabbing as much as they could, and then presenting that as a fait accompli to the center and saying, look, you know, kind of like a cat dragging a sparrow into the house and presenting it to its owner, you know, like, look what I've found, look what I've done.
Servette Francis Drake, I mean.
Right, no, it's the British were equally haphazard and exploitative in their time. But yeah, the Cossacks had expanded into these regions. They'd started extracting tribute in furs. And this is, again, one of many parallels that the Russian and Chinese empires before this era of socialism that we just briefly touched on, one of many parallels that they had, both fur extracting and tribute extracting empires, of course, in slightly different ways. But they moved into the region and started levying fur taxes from local indigenous populations who, at the time, at least in some numbers, were directing their tributary flows towards Beijing, the new Qing government, who, of course, had quite a strong connection to this region, having come themselves down from Manchuria. And so this obviously, as the Qing became increasingly aware of what was going on, cheesed them off quite significantly. And so they decided to move in and put a stop to this. And yeah, the practice of Russian colonial expansion at that time was, again, to parallel other countries which have expanded across continents, these wooden stockades, you know, just as in the American West, these kind of fortresses that were small. I mean, the number of people involved in many of these iconic historical events were actually pretty small. So a few hundred people had put together this stockade at Albazin, which I guess was considered to be really beyond the pale in terms of what the Qing were prepared to accept. And so they were successful at that time in booting the Cossacks out and getting rid of them for a time anyway.
how aware were they of one another? We have this, you know, with the sort of advent of powerful gunpowder armies in the aftermath of Tamerlane, and it's beginning really in the 16th century, you already start to see the sort of expansive Russian power. And in the 17th century, of course, it becomes, you know, a major feature, the sort of manifest destiny. But how aware was Tsarist Russia about the Qing, and how aware were the Qing of these Harrys coming from?
The Maozi, the Harrys from the north. No, I think there was a great degree of mutual ignorance at this point. I think the Qing themselves didn't fully know who these maniacs were on their northern fringes, and for the Russians' part, it seems pretty clear that they didn't have much of a clue either that these Qing forces who were fighting them and raising their stockades in the build-up to the settlement at Nerchinsk were the same people who were ruling this China thing that they'd heard about in reports from historical travelers. Of course, you know, Moscow was...
They called it Kitai, though, right? I mean, after... The Khitans, right? The Qidan.
Right, yeah. This word that's Cathay in English. The same. Yeah, it's cognate with... So they had this word Kitai. They'd heard of it as part of the European information flows that at the time were revealing secrets of the Orient to European elites, certainly. And it took them a while to match up the fact that this China thing was the same, or at least these people that they were fighting as they moved east were the same people as they'd heard about in the reports from travelers. Now, of course, there were Europeans, missionaries and other Jesuits and so on at the Beijing court already at this point, quite early on.
In fact, the whole negotiations at Nerchinsk were in Latin, right?
Right, in part, yeah. I mean, partly as a result of both having had their exploitative way with tribute levying in, maybe not exploitation, I guess there are disputes or debates to be had over the morality of that form of colonial co-optation, but... both the Russians and the Qing had their own Mongolian-speaking allies as a result of expanding into this area. And so negotiations, and again, this plays into the kind of mutual ignorance picture because neither of them spoke the other's language. The Russians didn't speak Manchu or Chinese, and the Qing, the Manchu forces, didn't speak Russian. And so, yeah, Mongolian intermediaries were part of the picture, but also Russia, being an empire that had also expanded west at this point, had various Polish Catholic or Latinate figures at court as well, and some of whom came along to the Nerchinsk treaty negotiations and were able to talk to these missionaries at the Qing court in Latin, which by the to have late 17th century is a last grand cameo for Latin, which was still playing a role, of course, in Neo-Latin speaking and using communities in parts of Europe and indeed even to an extent in South America at this time. But, you know, I think to see it there on the steppe, it's quite a no...
quite a tableau, I imagine. Yeah. I would love to see a sort of filmic recreation of this.
No classical Roman would ever have expected that.
No, indeed.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Talk about what the town of Nerchinsk is like now, though.
Yeah, it's
a sorry place.
Yeah, I mean, well, like a lot of places. To be honest, it's by no means the worst kind of place in those parts. But it's fair to say that 1689 flurry was one of its main historical points of prominence, which subsequently it arguably hasn't matched. It was kind of a frontier town for many of the ensuing decades. It then really started to go into catastrophic relative decline because the Trans-Siberian bypassed it when that was built early in the 20th century. It's not that far away, but basically if you were going to be a successful town or a successful population center, then you wanted to be on this new rail route that was being constructed there in the very sort of dying days of the Tsarist period. And having been bypassed, it was kind of a backwater and remained such until the present, with a modest sort of tin mining industry and so on, which was propped up for a while under Soviet subsidy and has since itself kind of collapsed. And so, yeah, it's a pretty... these places are very sort of somnolent places, it's fair to say, kind of Not as depressing as some others, I would say, because for one thing, the landscape around this part of, I guess, the far southeastern corner of Siberia, you might call it, is absolutely stunningly beautiful. These kind of rolling pea green hills, the kind of that you've seen from, you know, I guess, pictures of Mongolia, similar kind of a landscape. So, but yeah, definitely not a major fulcrum of anything much these days.
Another town you visited was Chita,
right.
And that was at one point the capital of a short-lived Far Eastern Republic. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. So actually, this coincided with exactly the time that Chu Chobai was passing through the area, and during the aftermath of the civil war that followed the Bolshevik Revolution in October 1917, the Bolsheviks basically fought their way further and further east. It took them 5 years to get from St. Petersburg, where it had all started, to Vladivostok. So there was, of course, 1917 is the iconic date that marks that revolution, but actually Soviet Union itself wasn't established properly until 1922, once they'd actually finally conquered all of what was Tsarist territory before that. And in that kind of intermediary period from 20 to 22, there was this Far Eastern Republic, which was set up as a buffer state, basically to cushion Russian or new Red Russian interests against Japanese imperial interests in the Asian mainland, which, as anyone familiar with that period of history in this region will be familiar with, was a growing force. And so for a period, there was this, you know, this Far Eastern Republic produced its own stamps and had its own trappings of statehood.
And for there, that there was even an embassy from China, from whoever warlord was in power, Duan Xirui or Wu Peifu or whoever was in power in Beijing, had dispatched an ambassador, and he actually met with Chu Chobai.
Right. Right. So Chu Chobai was basically held up on his way west repeatedly, because I think I remember learning in history lessons in Russian undergrad class that the Russian Empire, or the former Russian Empire, by the end of the Civil War had something like 7 functioning locomotives. Whether or not that's entirely true, I'm not sure, but my teacher was keen to stress that as a sign of the sort of decrepitude and the ravages of the Civil War. But as you'd imagine anyway, the infrastructure was in pretty parlous state. So Chu repeatedly had to stop for quite significant periods on his way west. And in Chita, he had a chance to meet various local functionaries, some of the Far Eastern Republic government, and also this emissary of the Republic of China, who he found a pretty frustrating figure. He seemed completely clueless about anything that was going on in China, perhaps understandably, given that what was going on in China was really not entirely clear to anybody, given the fragmentation. Pretty infuriating figure that Chu writes with this kind of amusingly exasperated tone.
As you get closer and closer to the Chinese border, you talk about this sense that an assertive Russianness was seeking to mask an inevitable Chinese influence in much of the Russian Far East. Can you talk about that a little bit? I mean, what form did that assertive Russianness take, and how did you see behind it this anxiety over creeping Chinese influence?
Yeah, I think a lot's been made of the fact that there's this huge empty Far Eastern region of Russia, population of 6 million, maybe a bit more. Of course, I mean, that's fewer people than big cities in northeastern China. You know, Harbin has more people than that. So there's been a lot of discussion of whether or not China is going to grab that enormous piece of territory. At least to my mind, and I think to those of many many Russian commentators too, that would be a lunatic idea. Why you would want to kind of try to defend that massive region when actually what recent years have shown can be exploited by just signing very preferential deals for oil and so on with the Russian government.
Or with farmland, right?
I mean, right. I guess that's one thing. But I mean, Dongbei itself is emptying. I mean, this has been known for a good while, many years, right? And so if the adjacent area of China is decreasing in population, why you would want to add a massive, climatically less favorable region into the picture, it seems a little mad. But
there are areas where the border is basically along a north-south line, and where climatologically it's identical on one side of the border or the other, but the population density on the Chinese side is you know, multiples of what it is on the Russian side. The farmland's the same. And, you know, throughout your book, you have people, whether they're talking about fishing or farming, they're constantly sort of carping about the lazy Russians on that side who, you know, if it were us, we'd fish the shit out of that. If it were us, we would be cultivating that land. And so there's kind of a natural osmotic gradient where you would think that a lot of Chinese would want to sort of move this west.
Yeah, and I think one remarkable thing that anyone can check for themselves is that if you go on Google Earth or whatever and remove all layers of borders and other kinds of markers, you can see where that border is. There are rivers along that border, most notably the Amur or the Heilongjiang, for large stretches of it. But even without that, you can see the way that land use varies just from space, right? Of course, which bits of Chinese borders can be seen from space has been a point of discussion for quite a long time. But this one, you really can see the distinction there. But to come back to the farmland or the kind of notional encroachment, there's been a lot of, there has been paranoia about that in the Russian Far East, specifically, I think, amongst generations of people for whom the presence of China in their lives is a staggeringly new phenomenon. Anyone who grew up during the Soviet period, when at least between the 60s and the 80s, China and the Soviet Union were in a pretty chilly, if not outright hostile, relationship.
Years ago,
right. Anyone who grew up at that time had nothing at all to do with China, despite often growing up within sight of it. And so I think the increasing presence of Chinese things, whether it's material objects, consumer goods, or people who are coming over as tourists increasingly, but also for longer as traders in the post-Soviet era. It's a big shock, and it has stirred up a lot of worries about Chinese, about exactly these kinds of things that you mentioned, that the kind of osmotic potential for what would happen if things were balanced out in terms of population and land use. But one indicative fact, I think, of how perhaps disproportionate some of those fears have been in the region immediately surrounding Vladivostok, for example, there's far more South Korean business and far more farmland growing soy and other crops run by and managed by South Korean companies than there is Chinese by quite a long way. And one's talking about a kind of,
South Korean
invasion. There are other kinds of Korean invasion that I think are making themselves felt perhaps culturally in the Russian Far East, but not
and in my household or my
where isn't it being felt?
Oh my god. K-pop thing. Your book is also peppered with all sorts of marvelous little observations that you make kind of offhandedly, but I would love, they turned over in my head and chewed on for a while and thought, oh my god, that's actually That's very correct. And one of them, this is completely unrelated, but a lot of the people you talk to are young Chinese travelers, and you just make this sort of offhand remark. On SubChina recently, we've been talking a lot about whether Chinese people should give themselves English or foreign names. Mm. There's a couple of essays that have been written on, taking one side or the other on that. And what he pointed out was, it just became obvious to me after he said it, is that the post-80s, the Balingho, they all pick, it's always, Rebecca or Vivian or whatever, or Echo seems to be really popular. Mm-hmm. And then the post-90s, they've stopped doing that entirely. And then they all go by their Chinese names.
Right. And this was very clear to me, I guess, from personal experience, even apart from that time, that specific trip. And some of these backpackers I'm talking to are young people traveling around parts of Inner Mongolia that I cross into, where local inhabitants belong to this Erlo Sudzu, the indigenous ethnic Russian minority of China, much mythologized, I think, rarely actually discussed. But these are areas which are kind of styled in a Russian way. And this kind of distinction, lots of these people are of the Jolingho generation. And I guess myself being a Balingho, my initial experiences in China were often encounters with people of my roughly that age, sort of born in the 80s people. And so lots of them were called things that vary from Vivian to less, to names that are more surprising perhaps. that I then actually during my later PhD fieldwork, I spent a year or so studying Korean in university in this Korean autonomous part of Northeast China that I also traveled to on this trip. And at that point, I was joining a first year undergrad class of Chinese students, all Han Chinese students studying Korean as a major. And they were all Jolingho, given the time that I was doing this. And suddenly, no one was called Simon or Amy. It was all just, my name's Zhe these things.
Let's rectify this lack of discussion about the Ilisidzu. You're right. We never talk about these people, but, and they are kind of mythologized. Tell us about the Ilisidzu, how many of them than there are, and how they were sort of stranded in China, as it were, and when they got there.
Yeah, so they're pretty intriguing, but I think also a very revealing community.
Argun, right? Argun.
Yeah, so there's this north, basically the northeastern part of Inner Mongolia. What was this Mengjian bit of the Japanese next to Manchukuo? There was this sort of Mongolian bit. So that bit of Inner Mongolia that's basically Dongbei, you know, it's kind of Dongbei is, I guess, the three provinces, Heilongjiang, Liaoning, and Jilin, plus that bit of Inner Mongolia. So they're in that bit of Inner Mongolia. And they are, their sort of Russianness is something that I really try to explore in the way that's being marketized these days as a commodity, if you like, for present day tourists, backpackers, or package trips up there. But their Russianness historically is also something that I think is a pretty interesting question, because they are largely descendants of people, these days several thousand of them. I mean, they're probably in the bottom 10 or bottom 20 of the 55 minorities. So they're not numerous. Most of them are there, but there's also some in Xinjiang who have quite a different history. I mean, there's much to be said, and I do try to say some of the things about the absurdities of both the Minzu system in China and its counterpart under the Soviet Union, the nationalist idea. But in any case, yeah, these people are actually largely descendants of Sino-Russian marriages, or not just Russian, but other Slavic peoples who moved across the Russian Empire as part of this colonial push. In the aftermath of Nerchinsk, in fact, patrols along that sort of border area, which Russia and China had, or Qing and Romanov, Russia had sort of hazily demarcated, patrols were not that numerous, and so people were not always that sure where they were. And so there were kind of informal gold mining settlements that developed there, and other pastoral communities of Russians, or of, you know, Russian imperial populations, more accurately put, because Russian Empire was a vast multi-ethnic state or multi-ethnic body. So lots of Russians were coming across the border there. Basically, the kind of match-up that then transpired between them and Chinese people really intensified as the Qing came to a sort of crisis point, the late Qing, certainly from the sort of 1880s onwards, when migration by Han Chinese was permitted up to the northeast and up to this region, including this part of Inner Mongolia. And so that occurred, and so many, many Han Chinese people started to arrive. And then not long after that, the First World War drew a lot of men from this Russian community in this area away to the front and away to Europe, where Russia was fighting until the Bolshevik Revolution in the First World War. And so at that point, there was this gender imbalance, these kind of many Shandong, Hebei, Chuan Guangdong, these migrant Han Chinese, mostly men, prospectors, and people just trying to survive and trying to escape really repressive conditions and famine and so on, further south in northern parts of China proper, mostly men meeting these now more numerous Russian women who may or may not have been spoken for, may or may not have had
widowed or yeah.
But in any case, even if they were, off, right? Their men were somewhere in some grisly situation in Europe. And so, yeah, actually, this community then kind of developed into this kind of Sino-Russian community. And actually, because of the remoteness of this area, I mean, even today, you can get there now on buses, and tourists increasingly are, but it still takes quite a long time to make your way up to that sort of part of the country. And in the past, it was a very sort of remote region. And so the community remained relatively intact in that the descendants or the offspring of these mixed marriages then intermarried. And so actually this kind of Sino-Russian thing retained its kind of balance for many generations. And
this is kind of exotic, you know, touristic selling point where people go there and are looking for those sort of, I mean, there's the Russian architecture, the carved wooden houses and things like that, right?
Right. It's been made into a kind of somewhat Disney-fied thing. Yeah. But I guess I try to ask some of these questions. I mean, of course, that looks absolutely appalling to a Anglo-American or a sort of Euro-American audience, the use of ethnicity in that way, or the marketing of ethnic identity. But, you know, speaking to many people there, I think you witness some things that I think other anthropologists, for example, have witnessed in Yunnan or other regions of China, where actually taking the Minzu identity that the state has given you and then selling it back to the state, or selling it back to the at least the majority population of that state, the Han tourists who come there.
Empowering.
It's a sort of resistance technique that actually allows you to do pretty well for yourself, and you know, you still know who you are, and you know, it's not too, and compared to the past, when at least during that Sino-Soviet split era that I referenced earlier, Russian identity in the Chinese borderlands was extremely stigmatized and problematic. I mean, actually, it's not a bad deal to be, you know, charging like 100, 150 yuan for a homestay in a pseudo-Russian wooden-clad house, which is these days the kind of the norm.
Well, maybe they should create an ethnic park for certain ethnic groups.
Yeah, good idea.
There was this another ethnic group that you looked at. I mean, look, the borders, as you say, were ambiguous then, or crossed a lot. I mean, even the two more obvious borders of the Amur and the Ussuri rivers, there are populations that live astride them, and they were sort of cleaved. And it's interesting to see how they developed separately. So one of them is the Hoja people, who on the Russian side are called the Nanai.
That's right. Yeah. 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 So these people and many other groups who've been, cleft asunder, as you mentioned.
The fisher people. I mean, these are the guys with the fish skin outfits.
Right. Right. Really historically. Stuff, yeah. I mean, they and many other groups related to them. These are, many of them Tungusic peoples speaking languages and being related to the Manchus themselves, right. I guess. And at least those closer to Manchu power, right. Sort of descendants of some of these northern people, who lived there in times past. They, living closer to Chinese power, were historically incorporated into Manchu banner regiments and so on, with varying degrees of incorporation into the Manchu, into the Qing state structure. But the border that was later drawn, I mean, basically looking at two kind of border periods in this region, the 1689 Nerchinsk era, and then 150 years later, perhaps even better known and more immediately railed against by online Chinese nationalists. A little earlier, 1858 and 1860, the treaties of Aigun and Beijing, which was sealed in those locations and basically incorporated the territories around Khabarovsk, big main city in the Russian Far East these days, and Vladivostok, the kind of bit that sort of goes south from there. And I include maps of all this stuff in the book, I should say. But yeah, so this did divide groups who had a varying level of allegiance in past times to the Qing state. And then those two groups were gradually estranged from one another during the sort of era of high socialism, somewhat earlier in the Soviet Union, of course, from the 30s in particular, when sort of Stalinist policies of ethnic kind of incorporation into the Soviet state were in full force. And then, you know, a couple of decades later under Mao, they really became, you know, very much a part of the ethnic regimes and indeed the sort of national culture of right. these two respective socialist behemoths, if you like, Soviet Union and China. And so that was something that, yeah, divided them to a certain extent for as long as China and the Soviet Union were officially mates during the 50s and early 60s. But then once things got really bad, they had absolutely no contact whatsoever. And so for the last many decades, they haven't been able to sort of meet or have anything to do with each other until the 90s, when some sort of reconnection became possible. But by which point, actually,
they had diverged.
Yeah, many decades of just the realities of life in these two different places meant that not only were they speaking different languages, but everything about their kind of everyday lives is very visibly distinct. I mean, fishing.
What they remembered about their ethnic identity seems to have like starkly diverged.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, of course, the difference between the Hoja in China, who have this history, however constructed and however spurious in many instances, as so many of these sort of Minzu histories of national loyalty are, but they have there's a plausible history there to be written about their connection to a Chinese polity for quite a long time. The Russian community, of course, there are fewer claims there to be made about their eternal ties to Russian Tsardom and everything that preceded the present. And so actually some of the, more fiery activist.
This character Leonid.
Right, yeah,
he's this kind of leonine also.
Yeah, he has this, the kind of very firebrand sort of activist character. He's still a good friend of mine. He and others in his sort of activist community among the Nanai, they talk a lot about having been the Jurchens and having been the Manchus and having lorded it over China, and how now they're in this really they're terrible position in post-socialist, post-Soviet Russia, where their villages are really decrepit. They were propped up for quite a long time by Soviet redistributive logics, which then collapsed in the aftermath of the Soviet collapse. And also the way the sort of traditional, quote-unquote, lifestyles that they've engaged in have transformed over time also is a mark of that. I mean, socialist policies in both China and in Russia move from their kind of ad hoc, semi-nomadic fishing and hunting lifestyles to being dragooned into these fishing brigades, right. these formally organized sort of ethnic fishing teams, almost a militarization of the fishing fleet along the river, which had a sort of militaristically devastating impact on fish stocks, which then meant that they were driven to all kinds of.
This could be a chapter in James Scott's Seeing Like a State.
I mean, right? Exactly, yeah. Right. Yeah. No. It's but the fact that they've endured those things.
Effort to impose legibility on this chaotic local situation.
Precisely.
Tell me a little bit about this. I landed. I mean, there's this one scene in your book where he shows up to meet you. In a square, he's wearing this really ostentatious blue silk embroidered robe.
That's right. Yeah. He has this
plan. And
that's right. Robe. So I mean, the kind of again, respective ethnic policies, both sides of the border have ascribed to their ethnic minorities a kind of archetypal array of clothing, of dances, of songs, of the kind of paraphernalia that one witnesses on the Chunwan, on the CCTV New Year's Gala or whatever. Very similar phenomena existed in the Soviet period, less so now, but in any case, there is this kind of canonized sort of repertoire of costume and so on. And so again, I mean, these things are used these days as a way of talking to the state, right? I mean, you wear your costume and then you become nanai in a way that otherwise it's very difficult these days to prove yourself right. Nanai. Russia no longer has the ethnicity category on its domestic identification documents. They got rid of that in 2007. So there's not like on the Chinese Shenfenzheng, there's no way of saying, here's my national ID, here I am demonstrably a Nanai or Evenk or Sakha or any other minority group. And so, yeah, he wears this very lavish embroidered robe, which has this Chinese, the traditional Fanti Zi character Long, the dragon dragon character, all peppered all over it. But, he sort of sheepishly says, well, look, actually this one divides down the middle, meets, across my chest here, but actually the real Nanai one is one of those ones more close to the Mongolian
on the side,
right? Yeah, up in the shoulder, kind of up at the neck. He's kind of, dancing around some of these historical, I guess, ethnic identifications, but channeling all of that into claims to be made against the Russian state and basically wanting to use that as a lever against these.
And you were telling me when we were chatting the other day about how he's really, really sort of fascinated with indigeneity everywhere now, I mean, globally.
Right.
Which is a really interesting side effect of his own kind of ethnic awakening.
Yeah, and I think it's also a really interesting side effect of the relative, what kind of, I guess, discussions or what kind of information networks former Soviet peoples and contemporary Chinese peoples are plugged into. Because actually, among many, many indigenous groups of the Russian Far East and the Far North and Siberia, the post-Soviet period has been one where interest in global indigeneity, in whether it's Native American populations or Maori or any other, indeed, global indigenous cause, it's been a huge sort of boom, most notably things like meetings across the Bering Strait between communities, riven by another national border between what was Russian Alaska and now United States since the 1840s, the United States and Chukotka. There's been a lot of this kind of inter-indigenous group communication and networking, whereas in China, very much still, at least from the Herja and other groups, including the Olosudzu and other minority groups that I spoke to.
Like cloven off.
Right? Yeah, they're part of a Chinese world, which right. is not so much part of those same discussions. So again, that's another, I guess, indication of that divide.
So let's move you along. You spent some time in Harbin, and you talk mainly about that city's history from, growing from a rail juncture, just sort of something laid down by the Russians, to the city of 6 or 7 million people that it is today.
Mm.
You talk quite a bit, though, in your history about the white Russian settlement there after the Russian Civil War, and the large community of diaspora Jews that was there as well. A really interesting city. I wish there would be more written about. I mean, Shanghai gets all the attention. What was happening with Kharbinsky's was more maybe as interesting, right?
Right. No, that's right. Yeah. No, it's a pretty unique, little, an island of Russianness. It started, pretty humble origins as this this rail junction, and the point where the Russian built China Eastern Railway that basically was actually the first link in the right. Trans-Siberian between the sort of European and Siberian stretch of the railway to the Vladivostok, because the route across that part of what was, of course, by the early 20th century, an increasingly sort of detached, fragmenting part of the collapsing Qing, was the much more, much shorter, more viable right. route. And so,
much contested, much fought over, changed hands many a time.
That's right. So in a sense, Harbin acts as a pretty good lens into the really incredible transformations and inter-imperial rivalries that were going on from that point in the very end of the 19th century up to the, well, really up to the establishment of the People's Republic, whether it's Japanese interest or Russian interest, or then the kind of many, many Russian interests that fractured or that emerged in the aftermath of the Civil War, when Harbin became this kind of island of pre-revolutionary Russian life right. in China, detached from what was now the Soviet Union, not too far to up the railway to the north. And yeah, sort of persisted in some version of that. But then, of course, under Japanese occupation in the Manchukuo period, and again, in the present, somewhere I'd really heartily recommend a visit at any time of year. Ice Festival is very well known.
Of course.
Blisteringly cold. Definitely take a hat. But it's a amazing city. And actually the amount of sort of urban fabric that is there from very all
many
sort
of, layers of it
yeah. many layers of it yeah. from the authentic kind of, all as authentic as you're going to get, genuine remnants of that early period, to interesting reconstructions of merchants houses built by Chinese merchants in the city at this period in a kind of European style, many of which lacked plumbing and were not in any way anything functional, more than these kind of facades of conformity with this this sort of quote unquote European city. And this sort of dialogue between Europe and Asia that I think is present in a huge amount of Russia and China's interactions over time is something I try and dig into, and I think Harbin provides a pretty interesting lens onto that.
Let's talk a little bit about the city of Hunchuan and its environs. This is where you did your dissertation research. It's near this so-called triple border. Well, I mean, it's not just so-called. It is the triple border, China, right. Russia, and North Korea. That alone makes the town really fascinating. But there are all sorts of plans now being laid for the town. It has, an important role to play. Talk a little bit about Hunchuan and its significance.
Yeah, so Hunchuan and this wider kind of Yenbian Prefecture, it's called Yenbian Korean Autonomous Prefecture, a pretty unique and to me at the very least fascinating part of what is overall I think quite a fascinating region. It I think exemplifies a lot of what you see today in terms of a really vast imbalance between Far Eastern Russian communities, which are very still very dilapidated, almost three decades on from the demise of the Soviet Union, still very obvious scars of that sort of imperial collapse, massively depleted populations, the physical ruins of the demise of many of these towns are just standing there around. And so from Hunchuan, which itself is this place that from the center, from both Yenbian, but also more importantly from Beijing, has been envisioned as a Northeast Asian hub, both logistics and transport, and kind of basically an outpost of the Chinese developmentalist dream, is, I guess, a particularly clear sign there of the mismatch between what is going on the Chinese side of the Sino-Russian border and on the Russian side. I mean, incidentally, there you also have North Korea, which provides a third very intriguing case study of what has happened to a socialist country, which was going along some kind of developmental trajectory for a while in the late 20th century, of course, to
completely derail.
More catastrophic consequences, even perhaps than the Soviet collapse. But I think it provides this sort of outpost of that still unquenchable Chinese optimism for all of these sort of totemic ideas of progress and development and even civilization and modernity and all of these things, which are not only problematic to or at least need to be interrogated by anyone trying to understand these from a sort of analytical academic point of view, but also in former Soviet communities where people have been suffused by that language for the latter part of the 20th century. Soviet Union also expressed its sort of state projects in the language of forward movement and this kind of Marxian understanding of a kind of teleological trajectory through time. But of course, since the...
its ability to deliver doesn't really quite match what China is.
No, and as I say, there are the physical ruins that surround people immediately across the border from Hunshun of the ambivalence of these kinds of, or the potential failures of these progressivist
it's
project.
Quite stark,
it's right? A very stark contrast. And what at least I found one of the more interesting aspects of my PhD research was, yeah, the way that Russians then perceive the Chinese impetus on the other side of the border. I mean, they can see, like, from the neighboring border towns on the Russian side, you can see Hunshun glowing at night on the underside of clouds. You know, on a cloudy night, you can do this kind of spectral glow of this, like, bustling Hunshun, which, you know, mixes its kind of Chinese and kind of I guess center infused development with a lot of Korean influence too, because the population of Yenbian, this Korean autonomous area, is still roughly 40-50% ethnic Korean. The Chaoshenzu, another Chinese minority, but this one with, you know, two countries to choose from.
What does this do in the Russian psyche for people who are there looking at the glow of the city on the other side? Is it just resentment, or is it inspiring to some people?
Yeah, I think it really varies. It's often a generational thing. So there are certainly those among the older generation who, as I say, alluded to earlier, grew up under in Soviet circumstances, which meant that they came to see China as something of a they didn't have much understanding of China or any contact with it. And so the fact that these people who and this is an undeniable fact that I try and bring out, sort of quote unquote Asian people in Russia, including Asian minority groups within Russia or ethnically non-Slavic peoples within Russia, have been discriminated against and condescended to for a very long time. And China, as this kind of, you know, notionally like chaotic Asian place in comparison to civilized sort of European Russia or Soviet Union, I think for people who see that, again, it plays into what we discussed earlier about the sort of the Chinese, the potential threat there. But younger people who cross over the border, who jump over and find something to do, study Chinese in some local center, you know, whether that's Yanji, the main city in Yanbian, the bigger kind of prefectural center, or
home of Lungbian.
Yeah, right. Home of the Chinese version of Lungbian, right, I guess. Hamhung and Pyongyang in North Korea are the two Lungbian centers, Nengmyeon, Rengmyeon in North Korean. But yeah, the people who hop over there, the Russians, They see these vast vistas opening out before them in terms of possibilities, right, associated with this booming China, and so they really kind of embrace that. And I think there's even interesting versions of sort of nostalgia about China being still officially communist, being a kind of echo of what the Soviet Union didn't manage to achieve. Look, these Chinese people, they've sorted it out, you know, they've figured out how to reform, they've made the system work in ways that we were never able to. And oddly enough, yeah, that kind of same Soviet thinking about progress has just been kind of transplanted in the minds of some Russians who are now involved in whatever facet of Chinese development that they find their place in.
And finally, it was on to Beijing,
right?
And the last stop on your journey up. I lived there for a very long time, as I think many of our listeners know, and I lived often in the very near vicinity of Russian communities, whether the one near the Russian embassy in Dongzhimen, or more often I lived sort of near Yabaolu, which is sort of near Zhishan Park, north side of Zhishan Park, south of Changmen. And in that neighborhood is fascinating for me. I mean, one hears all these lurid stories about how you can buy handguns from the Russians and you can do this. How did this Russian ghetto get established? And can we call it a ghetto? I'm not sure, but it's always just been a subject of fascination for me. And I'd love to see something good written more about that. But tell us what you observed in these Russian neighborhoods.
Yeah. So, I think both in Beijing and in also in Changchun, where I was immediately preceding Beijing, I wanted to trace some of the physical remnants of I guess historical influence on these cities. And so Changchun, having been the Japanese Manchukuo capital and also an important Russian rail junction, was something I tried to understand by looking at street plans and buildings and so on. And so I think trying to read Beijing also through a similar lens, looking at this, I guess, Yuan dynasty city plan, the kind of Kublai Khan era layout of the city, which, you know, obviously persists to this day. I think even relatively brief visits to the capital will, you know, familiarize people with the idea that there's this axis and you don't have to go too deeply into what's going on to look at that there's the sun and the moon, and there's heaven and earth counterposed across the four points of the compass. But what I'm interested in is the way that there's a kind of heavily Soviet influenced overlay on that stuff.
Right.
And so some of that is a recent socialist era Soviet influence, but equally the much longer standing Russian contact is also still evident. So that Dongzhenmen embassy area that you mentioned, in fact, that's a corner of the old Tatar city, as it used to be called in European languages, but the Manchu inner city, where the, you know, kind of exclusive realm for the Qing banner soldiers and the like. But this concession area in the far northeast was given over, not a concession in the same way that, I guess, extraterritorial concessions were made in the imperial period of European colonization, but this Russian district was created by, in fact, originally populated by people brought back from that Albazin fortress that the Qing had squished in the late 17th century. So a bunch of these Cossacks and other people fighting for the Russian side, who, as we already mentioned, a somewhat kind of ragtag band of semi-loyal, mostly out for themselves type individuals.
Some of them decided, I'm going to throw my lot in with these Manchus now.
I mean, the Qing win, and they kind of look like a better bet. And so, yeah, sort of not a huge amount, not a huge number, again, because none of the numbers involved in these early days were that big, but a certain community moved back to Beijing, followed the Qing forces back to their capital, and were given this kind of corner of the inner city in exactly the same place where the Russian embassy now is, that vast compound next to Dongzhenmen. So they have been there continuously, all Russians and their associated peoples have, all the way through these very violent and radical transitions from Russian Empire.
And when did Yabalu get started? When did that become so Russified?
Yeah, so that's a much more post-Soviet phenomenon. I try and find a way into that. Another thing I try and build a bit into the book is some of the sort of more contemporary cultural output of, I think, musicians and I guess rock and rap artists that I've been into over the last years of living in these two places. And so there's a Chinese underground or sort of relatively Beijing artist, Zhou. He goes by Mr. Zhou. He kind of goes by who wrote this song called Yabalu, which basically reflects on that post-Soviet emergence of Russians and former Soviet peoples in that area. And so this kind of emerged in the 90s and was, you know, is a home, of course, to Russians, as I guess is more generally known, but actually it's a real cosmopolitan space where you're as likely to meet Kazakhs and Uzbeks and Chechens as you are, you know, Russians.
People from the Caucasus.
Right. And this song, yeah, Zhou Fengling is the name of the artist. He sort of muses in this kind of drawling way about Yabalu becoming this new sort of place where Geiger Kaifeng dynamics were at play and these Russians were appearing. And I guess, I'm interested in that region, or that little corner of Beijing on the eastern side there, right, just east of Chaoyangmen, in relation to how Russians and Russian arrivals there in the 90s sort of presaged the onset of this new era similar way to how the arrival of Soviet experts in Beijing in the 50s as architectural consultants, as town planners, as industrial consultants, as political technologists, as every possible kind of model from Soviet system to be transplanted into China, their arrival in Beijing in the 50s was similarly the sort of dawn of a new period for China. And so actually, I think you can see that in Beijing's, both its population and some of the actual physical infrastructure of the city. You can see how Russians have, in a way, been the less heralded northern people that have descended to the capital, to Beijing, which, of course, has been fulcrum for Yuan power over China, subsequently Qing, that these kind of, you know, whether it's the Mongols or the Manchus who've come down from the north, actually the Russians and the Soviets have been this other northern group who've come down and left a pretty deep impression on contemporary China.
They've left also a street full of really interesting restaurants, which is right north of Zhutan Park, right, the sort of parallel to Zhutan Beilu,
of Zhutan Park,
West of Zhutan Park, which is lots of fun. There's Azerbaijani restaurants, and there was a Georgian place. I don't know if it's still open. There's a Czech beer pub, a couple of Xinjiang places, but there's this Russian grocery store there.
Right.
Pretty spectacular. Good sausage and.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, like, actually, yeah, that road you're talking about, I think, is just to the north. Yeah, Yabalu itself is to the west, but then kind of spills out into other adjacent areas. There's definitely there's a Russian side to Beijing that I think
we'll count that as a preliminary recommendation. But first of all, Ed, thank you so much for joining.
No, it's been a pleasure.
That's really fun to talk about, and I highly recommend the book. It's out
End of May in the UK, and then June in the US.
Okay, great. It's called Mirrorlands again, and make sure to check it out. Let's move on to recommendations. Before we do that, I'd like to remind our listeners that the Cynical Podcast is powered by SubChina. If you enjoy the reporting, the columns, the quizzes, the podcast conversations, and all the rest of it, the best thing you can do is just to subscribe to SubChina Access. For just a few bucks a month, you can really keep up on all that's happening in China, enjoy discounts and free admission to our events, and chat with our editorial team on our Slack channel. So tell a friend. On to recommendations. Ed, what do you have for us?
Yeah, so I think a lot of sort of Sino-Russian stuff can be found in the book itself. It's not effusively footnoted, but there are a few references to interesting things. So I'd suggest getting that where good books are sold, and then looking in there for ancillary recommendations to this topic. But I guess I'm interested in the more general theme of Northeast Asian or East Asian connectivity too, and having spent a bit of time in Korea and Japan as well. In more recent years, a couple of recommendations perhaps relating to that. This is not by any means a new find or anything that probably will be news to many people, and it may well have been recommended before, but I've just finished reading Pachinko by Minjin Lee, which is she's a Korean-American writer, who talks a lot writes a lot in her novels about diasporic Korean experience, and this one is based in Japan, and it's just an absolute deeply moving, incredibly vivid account of Korean experience in Japan. And then the second one, coming more from closer to where I'm based at the moment, there's a novelist, early 20th century novelist, I guess, in some ways a contemporary and someone swept up on the same leftist wave as the likes of Chu Chobai, a Japanese writer called Kobayashi Takiji, who wrote a number of kind of leftist minded novels in the 1920s and around then, including one which is called The Crab Cannery Ship, which discusses sort of proletarian experience of hard-pressed Japanese crab canners around Hokkaido. So as I mentioned, this is why it's linked to what I'm up to now. And they have some interesting run-ins with Far Eastern Soviet people who infuse them with revolutionary consciousness and so on. There's been a recent translation and kind of collection of his work, including that novel out with Hawaii Press, Hawaii University Press. So I'd really recommend checking that out for another kind of dimension of this Russia, Northeast Asia connectivity that I think is not necessarily a story that is always that widely told.
That sounds great. Will be very. I mean, I have not actually read Pachinko.
I'll read it.
Yeah, I will, absolutely. Yeah. I'm going to recommend something very silly, which is this 1982 TV movie adaptation of Sir Walter Scott's classic Ivanhoe. And my brother and I were chatting on the phone, and we were sort of reminiscing about that. I watched it a ton when I was a child. We had it on VHS. It stars Sam Neill, Olivia Hussey, who was Juliet in the version of Romeo and Juliet, John Rhys-Davies, who's Gimli in The Lord of the Rings, Peter Jackson one.
I think many of these things are to a Barling Hole. They're slightly obscure, figures, maybe.
I posted about this on Twitter, and immediately a bunch of Swedes told me that apparently this film has achieved kind of weird, iconic, slightly ironic iconic status, where there's a national tradition whereby the day after New Year's, they all eat pizza while badly hungover and watch this 1982 adaptation of Ivanhoe. It's a lot of good kind of earnest, but maybe unintentionally campy fun. I do recommend it, though. It's a good time. I mean, with or without the pizza or the hangover or the New Year arrival. Anyway, Ed, thanks. What a pleasure. It's been great talking to you about this book.
Well, likewise, Kaiser. Yeah, I've really enjoyed it. Thanks very much for having me.
All right. The Cynical Podcast is powered by SubChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn, with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at cynica@subchina.com. Follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News. And make sure to check out all our other podcasts: the Caixin Cynical Business Brief, the Pandaily Tech Buzz China, New Voices, China Econ Talk, Ta for Ta, and the brand new Middle Earth podcast on the culture industry in China. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care. Hey, Cynical listeners, we're really excited about the brand new show. We've got Strangers in China, which debuts next week on the Cynica Network. We're going to be running chapter one of the first season right here on Cynica next week. And, of course, we encourage you to subscribe. Let me introduce you to the show's creator, Clay Baldo. Clay, man, welcome to the network.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm good, man. How are you?
I'm excellent. I'm a little bit nervous because I'm usually on the other side of the interview, so... This is my first time being interviewed ever, actually.
We're going to keep you there on the other side. I mean, you do a really good job on the other side. So
nobody wants to hear my answers.
Well, they do want to hear your questions. So tell us That's a little right. bit about yourself. Where did you grow up? What got you interested in China? How'd you end up there? And that sort of thing.
Well, I'm from Connecticut originally, which is completely insignificant to the story. I would just say that I was born to an immigrant parent. My dad's from Italy. And I guess that general sense of just moving to somewhere new is very like, feels very real and deep within me.
Yeah.
So I guess like I had an impetus to go somewhere new. It wasn't until college when I started taking Chinese that I was like, oh, okay, let's try it. Let's try China. If you had told me 10 years ago that I would have been in China for 6 years of the past 10 years, I wouldn't have believed you. So it was very much, I don't know, it was a series of coincidences that kind of came together. And I ended up studying abroad in Beijing, and then I've basically been here ever since, except for the year that I graduated. So, yeah.
Oh, cool. So the name of the podcast, Strangers in China, I love it. We all thought on the team here, we thought it was a perfect name for a show about, you know, people like you interview people on the margins, you know, that's done really by people themselves who are foreigners or strangers to the country. Your dad's Italian, so you probably know that, you know, like strangers and foreigners is one word in a lot of the Latin languages. But after 20 years there, I often actually still felt like a stranger. So tell us a little bit about the name and how you guys came up with it.
I would say it was sort of kismet. I mean, we kind of were looking for names, and Strangers in China just sounded so good and intriguing. But I think the reason that it sounds so good and intriguing was because, as you said, that's a really good point. Like, we feel like outsiders, me and Cherie as co-hosts, living here in China for two different reasons. You know, she's Chinese American and I'm just like white American, and we both feel like strangers in different ways. But we're always trying to talk to people who feel estranged from their own country in a certain way, from their own society in a certain way. And so that's really why it felt like it was such a good fit when it really came down to it. We're looking for people who see China in a different way. And from my experience, people who see things in a different way are usually different in some particular way. So a lot of the voices that we feature are people who just couldn't make it within the system, or people who want to defy the system in some way, or people who live on the margin of society. I want to temper people's expectations a little bit, because we're not talking to like political leaders necessarily, or people who are starting big movements necessarily. We're talking to normal people who have decided within their personal life that, like, I just can't live like this anymore, whatever this is. And And we want to show sort of why their simple acts of rebellion, or some of them have quite grand acts of rebellion, why those are so interesting and why they're so worth looking at. So that's sort of our idea.
It's intriguing. People do cover characters who are outside of the mainstream, but typically because they are political or religious rebels or something like that. And you're talking more about little everyday acts of transgression or, you know, feelings of alienation. And yeah, I think everyone who's lived in China knows there's a lot of that. And that gives the place a lot of its character. You've been interviewing some really quirky characters for this show. Has there been anything that stood out, you know, that was particularly interesting or weird that's happened along the way that you might be able to share with our audience, with the reminder that this is a family show?
My favorite episode was going to Cinema Q, which is a queer event here in Shanghai. And just I did a lot of like vox pop, you know, like talking to people, just random people who went to the event. And the reason I loved working at Cinema Q was like the vibe, the feeling is so exciting. It feels almost like combustible in a weird way. It's like you have all these people who are nervous about being where they are, like nervous about talking, nervous about showing up to watch these movies that are sort of like not sponsored by the, you know, state narrative. So you're watching all these queer movies, these explicit movies, these really intriguing movies. And so the audience is like so excited because they're feeling represented, and they like are so excited to share with each other and talk to each other. And they were like very open to talking with us. So I don't know, something about that environment was just felt so like real and exciting. And I think it really comes across in the episode. So I think the listeners will really get like a chance to immerse themselves in parts of Shanghai that maybe they don't know about. So I'm excited about that.
Going to a queer film festival, that is a target-rich environment for a guy doing a show like yours. That's great, man. It's just a pity that you had this great co-host, Cherie. You guys launched the show together. I know that you had the idea for the show. You had done a lot of the production work already for a couple of pilot-type episodes. But Cherie had to head back to the States, I guess, to take a job. But you've got some other great co-hosts who are going to be joining you for other chapters in this season, yeah?
I do. So let me just say a couple words about Cherie.
Yeah.
My little love letter to Cherie, because honestly, if it weren't for her, like this project would have never gotten off the ground. I had so much like raw idea and I had so much like will to go, but without her like sense of organization telling us to slow down, without the name, she came up with the name, like all of like sort of the design sort of ethos aspects of it, as well as like bringing in a lot of interesting people to talk to, like this would have never gone anywhere. So I am eternally grateful to Cherie for helping me get this thing going.
All right.
And not just help. Sorry. That sounds like she was my partner. I mean, that's been like the real upsetting part for me, is like we were like partners and we fought and we like, that was the best thing, is that her and I had like a very oppositional relationship in a lot of ways. So we had like good arguments. And I think that shows up in the podcast. And we like were close and we were friends. And then we were also like enemies and we, you know, would fight. And so I don't know, finding that dynamic's definitely going to be hard again.
That relationship you described, that reminds me of another couple of podcast hosts I'm familiar with.
Oh yeah, me too.
Yeah. It works really well, that kind of oppositional thing, but you're also really close friends.
I think that I found a couple people who have interesting personal perspectives that will show through, and I'm excited about. I have my friend Yuki. She's a life coach here in Shanghai.
Oh, wow.
And she came in and talked to me about like sexuality in China. She was very open to talking about that kind of stuff. And then I have a friend Maggie who's going to come help me, who is like an analyst for social media and stuff. So she's very savvy. But you know, I haven't found that like specific Cherie energy that I love.
Yeah.
So I hope the show doesn't suffer. Yeah.
You know, as much as I loved Cherie being part of the show,
I'm sure you're going to continue to do some really, really great shows, and I really look forward to hearing the rest of this season.
Before we go, where can people find you on social media?
Okay, our Instagram is at Strangers in China.
Mm-hmm.
Our Twitter is at Stranger in China. There's no strangers. It's just one stranger. I couldn't get Strangers in China for some reason. Which is, so totally weird. And we've foregone doing the whole Facebook thing because, you know, who's on Facebook anymore?
I am. But, hey, but whatever.
My bad. Sorry, Kaiser.
That's okay. You are forgiven. Hey, Clay Baldo, congrats on the new show. We are really psyched about it.
Thanks.
Don't forget, it launches on the 19th. That's next week. So, stay tuned.
Yeah, I'm excited. All right. Well, thanks, Kaiser. Thanks for the interview. This is the first time I've been interviewed, so I was a little bit nervous. But,
You did fine.